welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of this Friday edition of the Hagman Report. This hour, we got a new guest coming on. His name is Mr. Dave Workman, and he is the Communications Director, Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, the Senior Editor of the Gun Mag, formerly Gun Week, the nationally recognized firearms journalist and authority, co-author of several books, including the most recent, Dancing in Blood, author of Washington State Gun Rights and Responsibilities, award-winning editorial and outdoor writer, formerly served on the National Rifle Association Board of Directors, and is also a certified firearms instructor. Folks, you can go to the website, www.thegunmag.com, and also saf.org. Mr. Workman, welcome to the Hagman Report.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me. Thanks very much. I hope we have a good Friday evening here.
Oh, absolutely, and I think we will. And just to let you know, this is Joe Hagman here. My co-host and father, Doug Hagman, is under the weather. One of the first times I can remember him missing a show from not feeling well. So it's just going to be you and me tonight. And I've done some research into looked on your website and looked at a number of things, and we should have a great show. Mr. Workman, anything that you want to tell the audience about yourself? I know this is the first time we've talked, the first time you're a guest on the show that we didn't cover in your bio.
Yeah, first and foremost, my name is Dave, not Mr. Workman. That was my granddad.
Okay.
I write daily for Liberty Park Press and for the Conservative Firing Line. I publish stories both online and in print at thegunmag.com, where, I'm senior editor. I also have an online column called Insider Online with American Handgunner. And I've written stuff for Gun World, Gun Digest, Concealed Carry Handguns. It has kept me busy and probably off the streets. So...
Well, that's good. You know, tonight, I think the topic was going to be the concealed carry skyrocketing. We were going to start there. And many people under Trump, you know, we've seen during the Obama years, there was a huge increase in the prepper movement, in gun sales and gun manufacturing. And there's been reports that, you know, certain areas there have fallen off as far as sales and the surge that we've seen. But interestingly enough, when I look today, concealed carry permits are increasing still dramatically.
Yeah, they are. I think that the most recent data that has been released from the John Lotz group, and for some reason it just slips my mind all of a sudden, he has estimated that there are now at least 16.3 million citizens in the United States who are legally licensed to carry. And that really doesn't include all the people in the states where you don't need a license anymore. And there's a dozen states right now that have what we call constitutional carry. So you don't really need a concealed carry license to carry a firearm in those states. And there's also a small but growing open carry movement where people simply have just decided to carry their sidearms openly and remove any doubt that they're legally armed. So it's quite a phenomenon going out there. I did a story this week for Liberty Park Press that revealed the numbers in Arizona, Michigan, Texas, Washington State. And Texas is above 1 million active concealed carry permits, as is Pennsylvania and Florida. Then you look at Washington State, where we've got more than 585,000 people legally licensed. And that's in a blue state, by the way. Michigan, I think the number is something like 620,000. Arizona's coming on with over 300,000 carry licenses, and they're one of the states where you don't need a license to carry. So I think you've pegged that pretty good. The interest in buying guns may have fallen off a little bit, but not the interest in taking care of yourself and carrying a firearm. That that is continuing really strong across the United States.
Yeah, and what was interesting about the statistic that you referenced is that out of the reported 1.83 million new CC permit holders, this is since July of last year, the biggest increase we're seeing in the demographics of women and African Americans. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. The women, I think, are discovering that when seconds count, police are minutes away, just like those of us who have been carrying firearms for years. You know, police try to do a really good job. They are really outnumbered by the bad guys these days, and they can't be everywhere at once, and they certainly can't be at the scene of the crime, which they usually aren't. As for African Americans, I mean, all you have to do is look at places like Detroit and Chicago, where the overwhelming majority of crime victims in those places are African Americans, and I think it's only natural that they would want to defend themselves and their families just like anybody else. So I'm happy to see that interest growing. I certainly encourage everybody who applies for a carry license to get competent training in the safe use and marksmanship, care of a firearm, and you know, take an advanced class tells you when to shoot and when not to shoot. That's all good thing. It's good thinking to do that.
I know I've taken years ago, me and my father and a friend took a law enforcement certified concealed carry class. And, you know, we learned things in there. And we live in Pennsylvania, an open carry state. But I learned things in that, you know, in that class that I still use to this day. And it's more than just, you know, learning how to holster your weapon and keep it from firing without you wanting it to, and to load and unload the gun. You have to learn how to take it apart. You have to learn how to clear malfunctions when they happen. If you're in a live shooting situation and your gun jams, you need to learn how to deal with that situation, as well as many. I mean, that's just one example of hundreds. So it is very important for people, even in open carry states where they may open carry, to take a safety class and even a concealed carry class, because it would never hurt. As the saying goes, it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And as you said, the police are not there to prevent crime. They are there to respond to crime. And I think a lot of people take that for granted. They think, you know, when something bad happens, they can call 911 and the police will show up right away and fix everything. But that's not the reality.
No, it's not. In fact, I live in a rural part of Washington State, which is east of Seattle by several miles out in the mountains. And when we call the sheriff, if they get there in 5, 10, 15 minutes, that's typically a good response time, depending upon where the deputy happens to be at the time. It's sad that so many people think that they can just call the police and wait and life will be all good for them and the cavalry's going to run to the rescue. But that's really not how it works, and violence can happen so fast, and it's over so fast, and the bad guys could get away, and then unfortunately sometimes when the police arrive, their first thing is to draw a chalk outline around your dead body. So, you know, we don't want to go there, and an increasing number of honest, law-abiding citizens are making that decision, and I think it's the right decision.
No, I would agree with you more. Can you get into statistics, or what is the areas where more people own guns, more concealed carry versus crime? Many people, especially in the media and on the left, will make the argument that more guns equals more danger, and that in you know, allowing citizens to have guns in certain regions and just basically anywhere in the country now, they say, you know, it creates that danger. But what is the reality of that situation?
It depends on whose research you look at. Now, John Lott has done some research that comes down on the side of more guns equal less crime. There are other people on the other side of the argument who just are adamant that having more firearms out there increases violent crime. I haven't seen any evidence of that, unless they want to go to where it's more guns that are in the wrong hands increase violent crime. Yeah, I'd be willing to bet that nobody in Chicago who is committing all these violent crimes, who the people responsible for all these random murders, maybe not so random murders back there. I think the body count now is above 400 in Chicago for this year. None of those people are probably NRA members. They probably don't support the Second Amendment Foundation, and I'd be willing to bet not one of them has a Illinois state carry license. But they're the bad guys, and they've got the guns. And now, thanks to lawsuits by the Second Amendment Foundation and the National Rifle Association a few years ago that forced the state of Illinois to adopt a concealed carry scheme, the tables are beginning to turn. More people are becoming armed. They're obtaining their permits. And, I guess it really does boil down to whose data you want to believe. And, you know, you're not going to get two people in the same room who are on different sides of the argument to come to any kind of agreement on this. One person will use the statistics his way, and the other person will use the statistics his way. Sometimes the data doesn't match. Certainly the arguments don't match, but I think that at the end of the day, you're better off, as you say, to have a firearm and not need one than to need a firearm and not have one.
No, you're exactly right. And the statistics can be taken out of context or skewed to make one argument or the other, and that does get very frustrating. And we see the media and the especially the left and some on the right's their opinions of guns, and they, if they had their way, they would just ban them. But thankfully, with Trump's let's talk about Donald Trump for a second. Anything that he's done or has not done yet as far as gun rights are concerned that has you happy or worried?
Well, the appointment of Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, was a good move, and it was a solid move for gun rights. Mr. Gorsuch is a respected member of the bench. He is what I understand is a constitutional conservative, which in my definition, that means he looks at the Constitution as a legal document. And interprets it that way. He doesn't try to reinvent the law from the bench. He's very much in the same groove as the late Antonin Scalia. I understand they knew each other. And Justice Scalia is the author of the 2008 Heller ruling in Washington, D.C. that actually affirmed that the Second Amendment is protective of an individual civil right, and that led to SAF's filing of a case that struck down the Chicago gun ban 2 years later in 2010. That was the McDonald case. That was the Second Amendment Foundation's really landmark case, because not only did it strike down the Chicago handgun ban, it also incorporated the Second Amendment to the states via the 14th Amendment, and that was a pretty significant thing. So now the Second Amendment applies to all the states, and that's really important. I can't begin to tell you how important that is, because it opens the door for an opportunity for SAF or the NRA or a combination of groups to file civil actions to overturn some of these ridiculous gun laws that we've been facing for several years.
Oh, okay, so I guess I didn't know this, that the Second Amendment did not apply already in all 50 states, that we needed to put other laws on the books to actually have the Second Amendment apply in different states. Is that what you're saying, that they had to re-legislate different laws in certain states in order to...
Well, this is kind of an odd deal. The Second Amendment is part of the federal constitution. Each state has its own state constitution. That's why we call it the United States of America. We're not just America here. We're the United States of America. So we got 50 individual states with 50 individual constitutions and the federal constitution. Some states didn't have and still don't have a right to bear arms provision in their state constitution, but the Second Amendment was incorporated to those states to affect local governments and the state government. And, you know, for a long time, when there was a legal challenge to some of the gun laws, they'd rely on the state constitutional provisions. And until the Supreme Court came down on the side of an individual right, there were a lot of questions. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense to people like you and me, of course, but that's just the way it was. Now that that question has been answered, and I think the next step, since we've already established that the Second Amendment protects your right to have a gun in the home, and it protects your right to have a handgun for personal protection, what we need to do now is get the Supreme Court to take one of the many cases that will come available on the right to carry outside the home for your personal protection. Again, it makes perfect sense to guys like you and me that that right already exists, but there are certain statutes, and I'm talking particularly about Maryland, New Jersey, California, for example. They want to make it really difficult for people to carry outside the home, so they don't give them, issue them carry permits to everybody who applies. And that simply discourages people from exercising their rights. I think that's by design. So we need a case from the Supreme Court, which, you know, that's the final arbiter there, to tell these states, hey, wait a minute, you're done denying people and discouraging people the exercise of their civil rights.
Yeah, and I mean, that does make sense, I guess, stating, but see, I just assume that the Bill of Rights applied, you know, unilaterally to all the states, and then they had their own states' rights from there. I didn't know that they were allowed to really differ from the federal law or from the Constitution as far as, you know, the main tenets. But I guess that does make sense. With this, the Supreme Court, and is there any legislation that's pending now that should concern or a gun owner should pay attention to?
There are a couple of pieces of legislation that were introduced earlier this year that I think would be helpful for gun owners to contact their members of Congress who are now home on recess, and their U.S. senators too. In fact, it would be wise, I think, for gun owners to ring their phones off the hook. The two pieces of legislation I'm talking about are the National Hearing Protection Act, which would make it legal and more accessible for average citizens to purchase silencers, which are actually sound suppressors. They don't remove entirely the sound of a gunshot, but they suppress the noise. Now, that's an important thing for protecting of hearing, I think, and it would also open up opportunities for people to hunt in areas that they can't hunt in now, except with maybe bow and arrow, because of the noise problem and the concerns that it would raise among the neighbors. And certainly for people like me who've started losing the hearing in one of my ears, because for years and years when I was growing up, I didn't use hearing protection at all when I was shooting. And, you know, there are a lot of people in my age group who have the same problem. And I really do like the idea of protecting hearing, especially on the growing number of indoor ranges that are around.
So you think that's related to the gunshots, all your shooting history, the loss of hearing?
Yeah, that and the fact that I drive down the road sometimes with my window open. So, yeah. anything that can affect your hearing, and particularly the loud report of a gunshot, that's something to be very careful about. And, you know, I wish I'd have known this lesson 50 years ago, but I didn't. And the other piece of legislation, which I think is incredibly important, and this is the one that the gun prohibition lobby is just going nuts about, is concealed carry national reciprocity. That would be a boon, I think, to armed citizens everywhere, because it would require states to recognize a concealed carry license from another state. Just like a state recognizes a driver's license, that driving is a privilege, and they recognize the licenses. Carrying a firearm and having a firearm, that's a protected right under the Constitution. And yet, many states, New York, California, Oregon again, Maryland, New Jersey, there are a bunch of them, refuse to recognize out-of-state permits and licenses. Passage of this federal law would require them to do so. And, you know, I think we know that the lawmakers from New York and New Jersey and all those other states I just mentioned, they are going to be adamantly opposed to that, because they just want to run their states like little fiefdoms and keep the people disarmed. They don't like the idea of somebody coming in from another state who's got more rights than their own citizens do.
And think about this, folks. The, you know, with the Real ID Act, and the passports now, you have to have a passport with a chip in it, and many states are even disallowing travel from one state to the other because certain states aren't complying with the Real ID Act, putting the chips and the right information into the driver's license. And the federal government is stepping in and saying, you know, you have to, all the states have to comply by this certain date with the Real ID Act, so everybody's on the same page. But with the gun laws, it's the complete opposite. And how many times have we heard stories of people getting in trouble, you know, from going from one state to the other, having their gun on them that they legally own and have, you know, permits for, and are getting arrested and getting, you know, felony charges in other states because they, as you just said, the licenses don't apply state by state. And I guess it's, you know, right now the responsibility of gun owners and that are traveling to find out where you are and are not allowed to take your firearms right now. But yeah, that would be a huge victory if they were able to get a universal state or nationwide gun license registration. That way they would know that, you know, if you have a gun in one state, you're allowed to have it in all these other states too. And that's the way it should be. That's the common sense way. But we know Washington and these people don't do anything the common sense way. And anything to stomp on your rights as civilians, you know, they seem to, you know, jump at the chance to do that. So, yeah, that would be a huge victory if they were able to get that through.
I think right now the Republicans are in kind of a tight spot, because they ran on a pro-rights platform. There were a lot of promises made. There was a lot of talk that went on. And now it's time for gun owners to really hold these folks accountable and say, hey, look, we helped you get elected. We gave you control of Congress. Now it's time for you to deliver on the promises. And they need to do that this year, because we know that when we get into the election cycle, the midterm elections, that's going to go away. It'll be all stump speeches again and campaign promises, and not really a lot is going to get done, because they don't want to risk turning some voters off. We need to do that now. And I'm pretty certain that Donald Trump will keep his word and sign that kind of legislation.
No, I agree with you. And if we can, let's continue to talk about politics just for a second, because you raise an interesting point about, we talk on this show a lot about the inability of Congress with the Republican majority in the House and Senate, with the president ready to sign legislation as soon as it comes to his desk, their inability to get anything done, even though they ran on all these promises from the health care repeal to jobs and the economy. And you are out there in the world, and you deal with average everyday American citizens on a daily basis. What is the sentiment of the people out there with the, I guess, with the progress of Donald Trump, but also the deep state, the establishment's ability to pretty much neuter his agenda? Do you get a lot of people that get into these conversations?
Well, it doesn't happen every day or every hour, but I know the sentiment of a lot of my friends, certainly, and people that I talk to as part of my job. It's the public is really getting tired of this stuff. Congress, I think the best what Congress does best is nothing. Now, let's get that right up front. They go through all these motions. They introduce things to committees, and the legislation will sit there and gather dust for months and months and months. And then suddenly there might be a rush to pass this or that bill. And when they do things like that, it's almost designed to prevent the bill from passing. They put on a pretty good show to show the public that, gee whiz, we're really working hard, we're doing something. But unless these measures get passed and signed into law, all they've really done is poke holes in the air with their fingers and give us a bunch of empty promises. Now, I'm a journalist and by profession. That's what I do. But I'm also a taxpayer. And as a taxpayer, I'm kind of tired of this. When we elect people, we don't elect them to lead us. We elect them to work for us. And that's something that a lot of people on Capitol Hill and a lot of people out here in the districts, they've lost sight of that. Those people work for us, and it's time for them to start delivering on their promises and their campaign and the intimations that they've given in their campaigns. You know, if they suggest they're for something, make them prove it. We want to see a vote on this and make them pass this. Otherwise, we're going to go out and find somebody else to do the job.
Yeah, and I think that these both people on both sides of the aisle in the political world are going to be in for a big surprise if they continue to drag their feet and not do what they promised and do what they... I mean, this is what, as you just said, this is what these people ran on to get elected, and now that they're in there, they seem to not to be able to do anything, and it's very frustrating. And so you just said that you were a journalist by profession, first and foremost. I want to get your opinion on this, and I think I already know the answer. What is your opinion of the mainstream media since Trump's been elected, and how has it changed, if at all, from before that?
I have written this, so it's fair game. I have described the quote-unquote mainstream media as a river where the current always runs toward the left bank. A lot of people, you have to think about that for a couple of seconds before they get what I'm talking about. But I think that what has happened since Trump was elected has been a combination of shock and disappointment, and I think bad childish behavior on the part of several people in the quote-unquote mainstream press. I think right now you see all this stuff with the Russia controversy. The only people who are keeping that story are alive are the media and some of their cheerleaders on Capitol Hill. I don't know how many times it's been repeated by people who know that there's really nothing there. So, but they just don't want to let this die. And I think one of the reasons that meme is being continued is because it distracts public attention away from the fact that Congress really isn't accomplishing anything. It throws roadblocks in the way of the Trump administration and the Republican majority from pushing through their agenda. And I think that that's really what's at work here, and that's really the bottom line. And that's very important when it comes to gun rights, because I think that over the next 3 years, we're probably going to have one or two more vacancies on the Supreme Court. And we'd like to see Donald Trump appoint and actually nominate people to the Supreme Court who understand that there are 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights, and that the Second Amendment applies to individual citizens, not some state's rights to create a militia. And
right.
that's also applies to the lower federal courts. Mr. Trump has an opportunity to fill something like 100 empty seats on the lower federal courts. And the Second Amendment people would certainly like to see the appointment of judges who understand that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual civil right.
Yeah, and it's taken for granted so much. Folks, our guest is Dave Workman. His website is thegunmag.com. That's thegunmag.com. And we're going to get into go to that website and get into that a little bit here soon. And also SAF.org. Dave, just want to get your thoughts real quick on, we see this, Mueller, in the politics, Mueller, the special prosecutor, convening a grand jury. James Woods, the actor, issued a tweet today saying if the Democrats are successful in removing Trump from office with their dirty tricks, that there would be a civil war if that were to happen. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I'd like to think there wouldn't be. I'd like to think that they're going to knock off this childish behavior and just let Mr. Trump do his job. He came in by surprise. Everybody that I know thought that Hillary Clinton was just going to waltz into the presidency. What Hillary didn't think about, and I think what she forgot along the way, is that you can't take the American people for granted. And she did that. She didn't go to Michigan. She didn't go to Wisconsin. She didn't campaign in a lot of places where Trump was there time after time, letting people know that he really did understand their problems and he cared about them. Now, Trump was not my first choice for president, but he's there. We need to allow him to do his job, to fulfill what promise that he offered the country. And I think that he's his time in office so far has been nothing short of miraculous in a lot of cases. I mean, look at the economy, for example. The economy is really growing. The stock market topped 22,000 the other day. We are surging. There's new construction going on. We're putting people back to work with jobs in the United States. We're not sending jobs overseas anymore. We've got a commander-in-chief who understands that the job of the military is not to push social programs, but to make damn sure that our enemies can't come over here and wipe us out. The appointment of James Mattis as the Secretary of Defense, the guy's a hardcore Marine. I tell you what, he's not the guy that I'd want to tangle with if I thought I could go to war with the United States. Because with him in there and with Trump in there and with the rest of the cabinet in there, if somebody tangles with us, they're going to come in second place. And there is no silver medal for somebody who comes in second place in a war.
Very well said. Dave, if we can, I don't know if you wanted to get, this is something you wanted to get into tonight. Let's talk about your latest book, Dancing in Blood.
Well, actually, that's not the latest book. Alan Gottlieb and I have done another book that we're both kind of proud of. It's called Right to Carry. And the subtitle of it is, I Carry a Gun Because a Cop is Too Heavy. And this is a book that it's fairly similar to one we did a few years ago called America Fights Back. And it's all about firearms and self-defense in the United States. It took us about a year to write Right to Carry, and we were pretty proud of it. And in the meantime, Dancing in Blood was our reaction and I think our exposure of a habit by the gun control crowd. They've become a gun prohibition movement to literally capitalize and exploit human tragedy, like Sandy Hook, for example, or Columbine High School, or the nightclub shooting in Orlando last year.
Yeah.
You exploit these incidents to push their agenda, which, you know, Alan and I think that's just disgusting. And
happens every time.
Well, yes, it does, and I think that says quite a bit about the mindset of the anti-gunner. You ask how low can they go? They never disappoint me. They always find something a little bit lower, and it's my job as a journalist to kind of expose that stuff. You know, they don't like that, I remember when here a few months ago, a friend of mine, Frank Miniter, did a profile of me for Forbes magazine, and you can find that online. And it was, I think, headlined something to the effect that if democracy dies in darkness, Dave Workman will light the torch with gunpowder. And it was a clever headline, but. He interviewed me by email, and I thought he did quite well with explaining what it is I do and why I do it. I went to journalism. I've got a degree in journalism. A lot of people in the news game, they try to portray me as a gun rights activist, which I'm not. I'm just a journalist who has a really interesting beat. And I come down on the side of my readers, because the other people in the media don't typically do that. So I make sure that the millions and millions of law-abiding gun owners out there, they get their story told. That's what I do. And so part of that job has been to partner up with Alan Gottlieb, who founded the Second Amendment Foundation, and he's also the chairman of the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. So we've done, I think, 6 books together now. And that's journalism. That's really nuts and bolts kind of journalism. We tell a story that nobody else is telling out there, and we back it up with facts. I think these books, you can find them online at Amazon.com. Every once in a while, somebody will send me an email or give me a call and say, geez, you know, I just read your book, blah, blah, blah. And that's great. I didn't realize that was out there. I didn't know this. You taught me this. You taught me that. And, you know, that's very gratifying, because at least somebody is reading this stuff and they're kind of getting it. Yeah, and really, that's the purpose of anybody writing a book.
Yeah,
it's nonfiction. When the reader finally gets it, and that's really been all important to me. Now, you know, if you're looking for something to talk about, I just won a court case against the city of Seattle.
Okay.
I've reported about this at Liberty Park Press and in the Gun Mag and at Conservative Firing Line, where I've got a column. About 2 years ago, actually 2 years ago this month, the city council in Seattle adopted a gun violence tax that they were going to use the revenue to do gun violence research and gun violence prevention activities. Now, you know, almost immediately, a historic lawsuit was filed to stop that. And the reason I say historic is because this is the first time that the Second Amendment Foundation, the National Rifle Association, and the National Shooting Sports Foundation have all been equal partners in a single legal action. In the past, NRA and SAF have teamed up on other legal questions. In fact, SAF and NRA sued the city of Seattle about 6 years ago to prevent the city from adopting a gun ban in city park facilities. But this tax was passed. The question is now before the Washington State Supreme Court. In the meantime, last spring, over a year ago, I made a Public Records Act request for the city of Seattle to reveal what it had collected in the gun tax during the first quarter of 2016. They refused to give me the information, as they are required to do under the Public Records Act.
And the reason they reason, okay.
Yeah, the reason that they use, and I can kind of understand this, is to protect the privacy of the individual taxpayers who are gun dealers in the city of Seattle. They don't want their tax, their personal tax returns exposed, and I can understand that. So I revised my request to just provide me an aggregate number, a total number on the revenue that had been generated by the gun tax, and the city still refused. Well, this went on almost all summer long last year. Finally, in late August, I sat down with Alan Gottlieb, who is also the publisher of the Gun Mag, and I made that request as the senior editor of the Gun Mag. So this really is, and always has been to me, a First Amendment issue. Guns really don't have a lot to do with this. And Alan talked to the attorneys, and we decided to file a lawsuit because they were just jerking us around. Last Friday, because civil lawsuits always go kind of slow in this country, last Friday, a Superior Court judge in Seattle, Superior Court, King County Superior Court, came down on in our favor and ruled that the city had to turn over the information and also fined the city $1 a day for every day that they had withheld it, and that fine comes to $377. On top of that, the city has to pay our attorney's bills, which come down to a lot more money than $377. But to me, it's a personal victory because the Second Amendment, again, has nothing to do with this. The First Amendment really scored a victory here. This was a win for the citizens of Seattle. They're all taxpayers. They have a right to know what money has been collected and what money has not been collected. And this case actually revealed that the city of Seattle passed this tax kind of on a, well, almost a fraudulent argument. They predicted that they would bring in $300,000 to $500,000 a year with this gun violence tax, which assesses a $25 fee on the sale of each firearm, a nickel for the sale of each handgun, rifle, and shotgun shell center fire, and 2 cents for each rimfire shell. Well, we did some math, thanks to one of the plaintiffs in the original gun tax lawsuit, who happens to be the biggest taxpayer in the of the gun violence tax. Turns out that the city has probably collected just over $100,000 from all the gun dealers under this gun violence tax. And that's a far cry from $300,000 to $500,000. I think the public has a right to know that.
Absolutely they do. And, you know, it's amazing what the government's able to get away with as far as secrets and keeping things classified. They can just say national security or put another label on it, really. And you know, that's their excuse as to why folks aren't able to see it or view the information. And that's very interesting that the and it's good to hear that you did win the case and that the Constitution, the law was upheld and ruling on the state of, on the side of a citizen over the government. You know, it seems to be getting becoming more rare of an occurrence than ever any time in history. Dave, we got about 12 minutes left, and I want to go to your website, thegunmag.com, and get into a few things. One, what is the 2017 Gun Rights Policy Conference?
Well, this, I think, is the 31st or 32nd year that we've held this. The Gun Rights Policy Conference is an annual gathering of probably the who's who in the gun rights community. We get scholars, we get legal experts, we get grassroots activists who attend this thing. We hold a day and a half of panel discussions about different things that go on in the firearms community. Alan Gura, the attorney who won both the Heller and the McDonald case, he is going to be there, I believe. John Lott is going to be there. Alan Gottlieb will be there speaking. I believe because of this case I just won, I'm going to have a speaking role. We have people like Masad Ayoub who've been there to speak in the past. Tom Gresham, I think everybody knows who he is. Mark Walters, another guy who does a widely listened to daily radio show on firearms rights. It's just a whole lot of people who come together for what I think is one of the most informative and educational opportunities for the gun rights grassroots activists. This year it's going to be in Dallas at a hotel, and you've got it in front of you so you can tell the listeners. It's right near or next to the Dallas airport. And so getting to the scene of the crime, as we say, is going to be pretty easy. And that conference is going to be held on the last weekend of September. Runs September 29th through October 1st. And I'm hoping to see people there. We typically draw a crowd of 500, 600, maybe 700 people.
Wow, okay. And folks, that conference, if you go to thegunmag.com or go to saf.org, you can find the information on the Gun Rights Policy Conference being held in Irving, Texas, and you can go there and register. And it sounds like a fascinating event. And you know, I got to go to Dallas a few years ago now for a conference there, and it's a beautiful city. Absolutely loved it there, and it should be a great place to host an event like this. Dave, looking at your website here, I see a few things that interest me. One, you have on your website on the lower right-hand side, useful gun owner links. And you have stuff in there from media links to different groups, doctors responsible for gun ownership, Jews for the preservation of firearm ownership. Are these all different civilian groups that have teamed up with you that you promote?
Well, I call them different citizen groups. And the reason for that, you know, we're all citizens, and we make no distinction between the civil authority and the military. We're all citizens, and these groups actually have joined forces with the Second Amendment Foundation over the last few years. Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership, they are a small but very loud voice in a medical community that unfortunately seems to tilt quite a bit toward the gun control crowd. And these guys they're intelligent, they're very academically oriented, they're skilled doctors, and they present some interesting arguments that you won't hear typically from the gun control crowd. Now, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership was started some years ago. The founder passed away, oh, I think it's been 5 or 6 years now, perhaps a little longer. The Second Amendment Foundation brought them on board. We have a small but very faithful membership in that organization, too. They have really their own, they march to the beat of their own drummer, I should say. And I think we try to work together with those groups. They do hard work at their level, grassroots type work. And I think that's really important. And for people who are out there in the firearms community who are looking around for a group to belong to. Look to your local gun clubs and then maybe join the Second Amendment Foundation. Join the National Rifle Association. Pick a gun rights organization that you want to belong to, because, you know, as a journalist, I've observed over the years that there really is strength in numbers, and particularly on this important issue. I can't begin to recall all the times that I have seen things happen that I thought would never happen, only because people turned out. They rang the phones off the hook. They deluged their congressmen or their state legislators with mail and with phone calls and with emails. That's the way to get these things done. And, you know, I get so frustrated by people who will tell you, oh, I don't vote, my vote doesn't count, or I don't want to make a big deal about guns because, you know, my neighbors don't know I've got guns. Hey, you know, we're in a situation, and we are in a time in history when you've got to make some choices, and you either stick up for your rights or you're going to lose them, because if you depend on somebody else to do your fighting for you, you're going to lose.
Absolutely, very well said. Just one more thing on your website here: is this the Gun Mag? Is this also a magazine that people can get subscription to, or is this a online?
Oh, sure, yeah. The Gun Mag is both in print and online. About 6 years ago, we changed the Gun Week format, which was it was a weekly, or actually came out three times a month. Toward the end, primarily because of the postage was killing us, but we changed over to a monthly publication, called it the Gun Mag, and where Gun Week was kind of the newspaper of record for the firearms community, we try to maintain that standard with thegunmag.com. You can find us online with daily updates. I know, because my son Josh is in charge of doing that. He posts stories every day on the Gun Mag's website. And then you can get the monthly magazine, which is in print, and subscriptions to that are available.
Well, that's fantastic, and definitely something to check out, folks. Go to thegunmag.com. Now, Dave, we only have a minute or two left here. Personal preference on home defense weapons. You're a shotgun guy, a handgun guy. What do you recommend?
Well, I carry a handgun almost every day. I keep a handgun handy. I like a .45 Colt Commander, frankly. I've got two of them. I think for a lot of people, a good home defense firearm is a shotgun. And, you know, watch, you'll probably hear a lot of whines from people who think they know about firearms, but frankly, heavy birdshot is a pretty good defensive load for home defense, because across the room, that load of shot is not going to open up really wide, and it's going to hurt when it hits. Also the .223 caliber rifle is favored by a lot of people, because the bullets are so small and light that they don't tend to penetrate too many walls. So, you know, it's a matter of personal choice and what you can own and what you can afford. And even if you can only own one firearm, use it, practice with it, and become competent with it, because it could be your emergency survival tool.
Yeah, that's one thing that we definitely learned, you know, with the concealed carry class I took, is that, you know, when you need to, it's like a basketball, when professional basketball players or any sport, they have certain plays that they run, and they have certain go-to plays that they run, you know, when they're in the fourth quarter and they're extremely tired and their stamina's gone, that they run these plays in practice so often that they should be able to do it in their sleep, and they do this for the purposes of when they're exhausted, when they're tired. When you run into a situation where you're going to need your gun, that training is going to come in handy, because you're going to be in that fight or flight mode, and, you know, you're not going to really any hesitation, and you could, put yourself in severe harm's way and danger, and maybe even a life-threatening situation. And it's so important to, if you have taken the responsibility to own a firearm, to get to know your firearm, know how to use it, and, you know all the ins and outs of it. You can never have enough practice. Dave Workman, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. I hope we can have you back in the future. This was a fantastic interview. And again, thank you so much.
No, I've been delighted. Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. Folks, the website, thegunmag.com. And if you're interested, the 2017 Gun Rights Policy Conference, September 29th, 30th, and October 1st in Dallas, Texas. Go to thegunmag.com. It's right at the very top right-hand side. You can click there and register and get all the information. But as Dave said, bookmark the site, The Gun Mag, as he said, his son updates it regularly with stories and whatnot and content. And it's a very interesting site. Folks, we are coming up against the break. When we come back, we are going to be joined by another first-time guest. And apparently some people in the chat that I've seen are already familiar with this man, a Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson. And he is the author of the book, The Antidote, Healing America from the Poison of Hate, Blame, and Victimhood. And folks, if you're interested in his book, you can go to the banner at the top of our site, Hagman Report, and there is the WorldNet Daily banner, and just use the promo code Hagman, and you will get a discount on the book. We'll be right back after these short messages. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to this edition of the Hagman Report.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.